heartache following the recent massacre in Buffalo that left 10 people dead and 3 wounded, critical observers say the racial animus, which evidence shows motivated the killer, must be seen in the larger context of a white nationalist mindset that has increasingly broken into the mainstream of the right-wing political movement and Republican Party in recent years. Taken into custody at the scene of the mass shooting at Top Market and identified as Peyton Gendron, the white 18-year-old male charged with the murders of the victims live streamed his attack online, where he also posted a detailed 180-page document that has been described by those who have reviewed it, including journalists and law enforcement, as a white nationalist manifesto rife with anti-black racism, anti-Semitism, and conspiracy theories about white replacement. According to local outlet News 4 in Buffalo, the document, which News 4 has reviewed, plotted the attack in grotesque detail. The writer plotted his actions down to the minute, including diagrams of his path through the store, and said he specifically targeted a Tops Market's location on Jefferson Avenue because its zip code has the highest percentage of black people close enough to where he lives. "This was pure evil," said Erie County Sheriff John Garcia during a press conference recently. The killings, he said, was a straight-up racially motivated hate crime from somebody outside of our community. A senior law enforcement official in Buffalo told NBC News that they were working to verify the document's authenticity and confirm Gendron was behind it. "We are aware of the manifesto allegedly written by the suspect, and we are working to definitely confirm that he is the author," the official says. With these and other facts established about Gendron's apparent motivations and ideology, many of those horrified by the recent killings responded by saying the brutal and deadly attack in Buffalo cannot and should not be separated from the growing embrace of this kind of violent far-right nationalism that has increasingly found a home inside more mainstream institutions in the U.S., including right-wing media outlets like Fox News and a Republican Party enthralled by the xenophobia and fascist conspiracy theories of Donald Trump. "We are horrified, heartbroken, and enraged at the news of the vicious attack on our neighbors and loved ones in Buffalo, New York," said People's Action, the progressive advocacy group, in a statement. The group added, "This racist attack is a pure example of evil. It's also the predictable result of the relentless onslaught of white nationalist conspiracy theory spewed from the far right, increasingly distributed by major corporate news outlets like Fox News and the extremist politicians their billionaire allies have cultivated. In Christchurch, New Zealand, and El Paso, Texas, and Poway, California, and now again in Buffalo, New York, a gunman motivated by a white nationalist conspiracy theory about invading immigrants shot and killed people of color," said Somaya Wahid, senior policy counsel for Muslim Advocates, in a statement referencing a series of mass shootings carried out by white supremacists in recent years. Wahid continued, "Just like in Christchurch, the alleged Buffalo shooter both posted a manifesto about the Great Replacement conspiracy theory and also live-streamed his massacre in social media. Our hearts go out to the families of the victims and to the people of Buffalo." In a statement recently, Kenna Collins, a gun violence prevention advocate and Democratic congressional candidate running for Congress in Illinois' 7th District, made similar arguments, calling the shooting a devastating and sickening display of the racism, white supremacy, hate, and gun violence that plague the United States. Collins said black people in Buffalo were targeted for no reason other than that they are black. This was an act of terrorism, and it should be treated as such, she added. It is another reminder that white supremacy has and will always be America's greatest threat. White supremacy has infiltrated our military and police departments. It was also on display on January 6 last year as insurrectionists, fueled by white supremacy, attacked our Capitol and threatened the lives of sitting members of Congress, unquote. Journalist Sam Sachs also made a connection between the Buffalo shooter and the Big Lie movement that drove the January 6 insurrection last year. Wahid, in his statement, said, "This hateful white nationalist rhetoric is not just being spread by lone gunmen. Such rhetoric," he said, "can also be found on cable news and in the rhetoric of politicians in the United States today." On his cable news show, Tucker Carlson said that the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate, the voters now casting ballots, with new people, more obedient voters from the third world. In campaign ads, Donald Trump described Latino immigrants as an invasion. In a speech, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene called the election of Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib an invasion of the U.S. government. With Republicans and major media personalities normalizing white nationalist, anti-immigrant, anti-black, anti-Latino, and anti-Muslim conspiracy theories, and gunmen like the one in Buffalo carrying out such attacks, Wahid said it is now clear that white nationalism is the greatest threat to the U.S. security, and we must hold everyone who spreads this hate accountable before anyone else is harmed.
Free territory.
Part 3.
During my childhood, the conquest of desert was a dream that took me on a vacation to Patagonia. 200 kilometers on a straight line through the province of La Pampa.
Almost 150 years have passed since the Argentine Republic launched an offensive to expand its borders and dispose the indigenous people of their ancestral lands in the south part of the country. The conquest of the desert was not a trip. It was a campaign of extermination carried out by its two main protagonists, Julio Argentino Roca and Remington Rifles, who came from the United States. Julio Argentino Roca was a 35-year-old young general with a brilliant military career. In 1878, he was Minister of War and Navy. He was the intellectual and material author of the first genocide in the history of Argentina. While he was presenting his plans for the desert campaign to the assembly, he said, "We have 6,000 soldiers who are armed with the latest modern military inventions in order to fight against the 2,000 Indians who have no defense other than dispersion and no weapons other than the primitive spear." Benetton owns 900,000 hectares acquired in a transaction in 1991. During the previous 100 years, an English company registered in Argentina under the name Argentine Southern Land Company had the control of the land. In 1890, just after the end of the Desert Campaign, then-President Miguel Juarez Celman ceded those 900,000 hectares by decree as the Argentine state wished to populate Patagonia with white Europeans. The land was given away free of charge, without paying a single peso, just due to the commitment to bring in settlers and make investments. The vice president, Carlos Pellegrini, criticized this decision, and Juarez Celman replied in a letter that it was preferable to create an Ireland in Patagonia, to which it was submitted by the negligence of the Tehuelche. Juarez Celman was Roca's brother-in-law. Santiago Maldonado lost his life and disappeared after an action of state repression here in this area. There isn't a centralized government in the structure of Mapuche organization. In historical terms, this culture has given them a great power of military resistance. The Spanish conquistadors could vanish Mayas and Incas, but they couldn't do the same thing to the Mapuche nation, so they had to sign peace treaties recognizing the existence of this nation. As a counterpart, this worldview has prevented processes of broader unity. For centuries, different Mapuche camps have fought among themselves and did not come to an agreement for many times to confront the white man or Huinca. But the conquistadors took the most advantage of this opportunity. On the Patagonian plateau lives Eusebio Antiaco. This is the Costa de la Paz. The leader of Mapuche, Sofia Antiaco, joins the meeting. This community has a feature. Eusebio's father created the flag that symbolizes the union of the Mapuche and Tehuelche people. Private funds have advanced over the community territories. Mainly the Lebanese landowners, Meljem and Said Bestine, and the Italian businessperson Luciano Benetton. In 1997, the provincial state admitted that the land had been improperly fenced. The Wire. It made me think about The Wire. The first Argentine legislation on this element dates back to 1860. The original people that are estimated to have lived 9,000 years before in these territories had never used it. Aldo lives here. He is Eusebio's brother, who provides valuable documentation. In 1940, a commission from the Ministry of Agriculture visited the region to evaluate a possible eviction. In the conclusion, it affirmed that the inhabitants had no working habits and assured that those who lived there had an absolute lack of morals. The report valued the eviction as counterproductive, alleging that expelling the indigenous people would be accompanied by the occupation of other lands susceptible to being exploited, where those inhabitants could provide a better field of action for their bad habits. The commission suggested the convenience of reserving the entire 77,500 hectare colony to accommodate indigenous families, including the 80 who were living there at the time. In As a direct consequence of the work of this delegation, 2 years later, the conservative president, Ramon Castillo, decreed to cede 74,432 hectares to be occupied free of charge in the indigenous concentration. Only 6,000 remain as community land out of the 74,000 hectares. Now we walk towards the ranch that is controlled by Benetton. The entire path is within the territory granted by the decree of Ramon Castillo. We must avoid being discovered by the custodians of the territory. We are doing well, the camera cannot capture it, but a sacred bird accompanies our journey. Although an Eusebio feels strengthened. After almost 5 hours of walking, we finally entered the territory controlled by Benetton. Eusebio, Aldo, and the rest of the interviewees have opened the doors of their world to me. They have hosted me and have shared their food and spirituality with me. Racism goes through all this conflict. Dispossession was not recognized by the state, and the mass media misinforms with the same discrimination burden. It is time to return home by the same old desert road. I am no longer a child, and now I feel the state is the infant which cannot sit with these men and women as equals and share mate tea and tortas fritas.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the US, Republican politicians, including some of the party's top leaders, openly espouse versions of a white supremacist conspiracy theory, holding that an orchestrated effort is underway to displace white Americans. A recently published opinion poll found that almost half of Republicans believe that immigrants are being brought to the United States as part of such an effort. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, "The Buffalo Shooting Was Not a Random Act of Violence."
Oh.
the U.S. Republican politicians, including some of the party's top leaders, openly espouse versions of a white supremacist conspiracy theory, holding that an orchestrated effort is underway to displace white Americans. A recently published opinion poll found that almost half of Republicans believe that immigrants are being brought to the United States as part of such an effort. On Saturday, 14th of May, a gunman who said he was motivated by a version of this so-called replacement theory killed 10 people at a Buffalo, New York grocery store, according to officials. The suspect, identified as Peyton S. Gendron, wrote in an online diatribe that he sought to kill black people because he wanted to prevent white people from losing their rightful control of the country. Peyton Gendron described himself as part of a movement. He said that he was inspired by similar attacks on other minority communities and that he hoped others would follow his example. The suspects in several mass killings in recent years, including the 2015 murder of 9 black worshippers at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, the 2018 murder of 11 Jewish worshippers at a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the 2019 murder of 51 Muslim worshippers at a pair of mosques in New Zealand, and the 2019 murder of 23 people, many of them Latinos, in El Paso, Texas, also propounded versions of this racist worldview. American life is punctuated by mass shooting incidents that are routinely described as idiosyncratic. But these attacks are not random acts of violence. They are part of a long American history of political violence perpetrated by white supremacists against black people and other minority groups. Politicians who have employed some of the vocabulary of replacement theory generally do not make explicit calls for violence. The office of one of those politicians, Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, said in a statement that the Buffalo attack was an act of evil and that she has never advocated for any racist position. But the matter is not so simple. Replacement theory is an attack on democracy. It privileges the purported interests of some Americans over those of others, asserting, in effect, that the will of the people means the will of white people. It rekindles fears and resentments among white Americans that cynical practitioners of American politics have stoked throughout the nation's history. It also provides a disturbing rationalization for people inclined to resort to violence when the political process does not deliver what they want or protect what they see as their place in society. The Fox News Channel host, Tucker Carlson, a leading purveyor of replacement theory rhetoric, has promoted the idea that elites are seeking to replace white Americans on more than 400 episodes of his program on Fox News Channel, according to an analysis by the New York Times. Now, I know that the left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate. The voters now casting ballots with new people, more obedient voters from the third world, Tucker Carlson said on an episode in April of 2021. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Representative Matt Gaetz, a Florida Republican, later tweeted that Tucker Carlson is correct about replacement theory as he explains what is happening in America. In September, Elise Stefanik's re-election campaign paid for a Facebook advertisement that combined imagery of immigrants with the accusation that radical Democrats are planning their most aggressive move yet, a permanent election insurrection. Elise Stefanik's advertisement continued. Their plan to grant amnesty to 11 million illegal immigrants will overthrow our current electorate and create a permanent liberal majority in Washington. Right-wing rhetoricians in the United States portray undocumented immigrants as the primary threat. This sanitizes replacement theory for mainstream consumption without diluting its logic. The same argument is easily applied to other minority groups in the United States. The French author Renaud Camus coined the term the Great Replacement in a 2011 book to describe what he saw as a conscious effort by French elite to open the country's doors for Muslim immigrants to replace the ethnically French population and French culture. The template has been adapted for use by extremists around the world. Mr. Gendron wrote that he blamed Jews for orchestrating the replacement of white Americans. He copied large portions of his manifesto from the document posted to justify the New Zealand killings, in some cases, inserting the name of Jewish businessman George Soros in place of the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel's name. The manifesto posted by the El Paso shooting suspect, which Mr. Gendron also referenced, spoke of the Hispanic invasion of Texas. The common thread, the ineluctable core of replacement theory, is that some people are white and some people are not, and that the people who are white are threatened by those who are not. It must also be emphasized that the United States makes it easy for domestic terrorists to kill. The police said that the Buffalo assailant used a Bushmaster XM-15 rifle that he had purchased legally at a gun shop near his hometown. As a practical matter, almost anyone can buy guns that are designed to kill a lot of people quickly. The only real line of defense is the judgment of the people who sell guns. He didn't stand out, because if he did, I would have never sold him the gun, Robert Donald, the store's owner, told the New York Times. The focus on the gunman's motive should not obscure the fact that the most important step the government can take to impede similar attacks is to limit the availability of guns in the United States. The health of American democracy also requires the constructive use of free speech, especially by the nation's political leaders. There are always demagogues whose stock in trade is the demonization of immigrants and other minority groups. And American society has long allowed those on the fringes to air their views. The question in any era is whether such views are voiced or echoed by those in positions of responsibility. It is telling that House Republicans last year installed Elise Stefanik in leadership to replace Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, who remains among the most forthright critics of the Republican Party's illiberal turn. Liz Cheney tweeted on Monday, "The House GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. History has taught us that what begins with words ends in far worse. GOP leaders must renounce and reject these views and those who hold them." And Liz Cheney is certainly right.
Yani.
Bazaar.
Fire clay is basically mud, but a lighter, stickier type of mud with high alumina content. It's actually everywhere around us, but cannot be seen until it is uncovered from the earth. In its raw form, fire clay is found near or between layers of coal in coal mines. People have been extracting it from the ground for millennia to make bricks, ceramicware, tools, homes, and a whole bunch of other things. Its qualities get even better when it's baked and stiffened. This clay has a great number of industrial uses and lasts nearly forever.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week we're going to venture through the vast world of fire clay and its byproducts. We will take a look at where it comes from and why it is so important to several industries that make our lives hum. We also want to understand just how this item fits into the bigger picture of the national economy. So let's start the show. Our quest for answers led us to a company that owns and manages at least five mines in Fars province. Esterlal Obade Company specializes in the extraction of fire clay and the production of clay products. Fire clay is a refractory material that can withstand extremely high temperatures without losing its original properties. There are other types of refractories that this company also produces in small amounts, such as high alumina and melite ceramics. But its main claim to fame is the production of highly useful fire clay. It might be interesting to know that this company is not just a mine owner. It also has three factories. These factories make products like fire brick, washroom items such as sinks, and industrial ceramics. Its production facilities can make large amounts of ceramic parts that are used in various fields such as blast furnaces for coke, iron, and steel productions. Because fire clay is heat-resistant, this material presents excellent qualities for outdoor flooring purposes. One of the benefits is it doesn't crack or expand when exposed to hot climates. That is why it is widely used across the country, particularly in central and southern regions where temperatures can often exceed 45 degrees Celsius.
The quality of fire clay is assessed by its levels of impurities. This company can produce some of the highest-grade fire clays in the West Asian region with around 75% purity. In general, when the material is extracted, it is then transferred to the Research and Development Department where it is tested for quality. One of the competitive advantages of this company over similar firms in this field is the quality of its products that match international standards. This holding company has created dozens of direct job opportunities over the years, and hundreds more people are indirectly hired as well. Out of some 50 fire clay mines nationwide, this mine has been the only producer that extracts its products along the lines of exports. This company has faced many challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Some are related to the fluctuation of domestic raw material prices. As part of its future vision, it has also overhauled production processes to optimize outputs. Besides the mine we just talked about, there is one other major fire clay deposit which is located in Charmahal Bakhtiari province. This mine offers 12 million tons of proven reserves and it is set to produce some of the best quality refractories in the region. Each year, a combined average of 300,000 tons of fire clay are exported.
Music.
Iran's tile and ceramic market have become very attractive with rapid socioeconomic development in the West Asian region. Also, there is an increasing need for new housing units in neighboring countries. There are some of the things that are driving Iran's export market in this field. So the country has stepped up its production to gain a larger share of the market. We looked at the latest figures from the Ministry of Industry to gain more insight into the productions in this field. Data showed that in the year 2020, roughly 400 million square meters of tile were produced in Iran. Such productions were estimated to be worth nearly $450 million. These productions were more than local needs, so nearly 160 million square meters of tiles were exported. Industry participants say that this sector is presently operating at only half of its total production capacity, adding that it has high export potential. With this in mind, the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade is working with the government to find ways to expand its markets through production. The goal is to increase production levels by 300 million square meters over the next 4 years. Analysts estimate that this will generate an additional $2 billion in foreign revenues if the strategic sector taps into the full capabilities. Fire clay does not only feed the tile productions. It also supplies raw material to manufacturers of sanitary ceramic ware such as sinks. Iran currently makes copious amounts of these items. In fact, in the first half of last year alone, over 70,000 tons of sanitary ware were released into the market. Going off on information from the National Customs Administration, these items were mainly exported to neighboring countries. The country's light and heavy construction sector is booming with construction materials in high demands. It is worth noting that domestic raw materials such as fire clay meet 100% of Iran's construction needs. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here are some statistics on the construction materials market. Iran's steel, cement, tile, and ceramic industries produced more than twice the country's internal needs. Last year, exports of these items raked in some $10 billion in foreign revenues. Tile, glass, and ceramic exports compose some $3 billion of total exports. Steel exports accounted for the rest. That's all based on statistics from the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. On another note, the country's mega mining and metal sector, which also supplies the construction sector, has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. Industry participants say this was mainly due to the U.S. sanctions on the oil industry, which led to more focus on other sectors. Much of this expansion is in large part made possible by linking research institutions with manufacturers. This step was critical for sharing knowledge in collaborative product development. Catalysts are the unsung heroes of the chemical reactions that make human society tick by. They help speed up chemical processes between molecules that might have been taken years to interact. Factories rely on catalysts to make everything from plastic to drugs. Catalysts also help process petroleum and coal into liquid fuels and are key players in clean energy technologies as well. However, their biggest use happens in the oil and gas industries. This week, we're going to explore the expansive world of catalysts. We wanted to see who the major players in this field are and some of the applications of catalysts. Now we will uncover how these tiny but mighty substances have made massive contributions to the national economy. It's going to be a fun one, so let's start the show. To familiarize ourselves with what catalysts are and where they are used, We visited a company specializing in making these items. Sarv Gas and Oil Company is a knowledge-based firm that has been active in this field for nearly two decades. This company makes a wide range of catalysts in 30 different types. Among its products, one can name catalyst used for the synthesis of formaldehyde, which is handy in the production of methanol. But that's not all. The products made here are extensively used to make raw materials with applications in numerous other production industries. Among its numerous achievements, this company has also obtained the know-how for making machinery and equipment necessary to complete various catalyst production chains. And that's not an easy task. A lot of hard work and science goes into making catalyst. That is why not all catalysts are created equal. Some are made with lower quality depending on the means and production methods, because catalysts are used to make other items through chemical processes. Having good quality catalyst is crucial in making high quality final products. This company serves two major roles: high-quality catalyst production and product development. As a knowledge-based company, the research and development department holds the pulse of these activities. It has dedicated much of its resources to furnishing its department with the latest technology to get the job done. Knowledgeable experts run its research and development department. Among its staff, this company employs engineers, scientists, researchers, and a whole host of other experts. Over the years, it has created hundreds of direct job opportunities as well. This company has overcome numerous obstacles to enjoy its many hard-earned achievements. One such challenge has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. Some time ago, catalysts were placed on the U.S. sanctions list, so this company stepped up to the plate to fill in the market void, turning a challenge into an opportunity. With nearly 20 years of experience under its belt, this company has gained significant ground in the market. It is also known for being one of the first businesses to export catalysts. As part of its future vision, it wants to manufacture machines and catalysts that will complete various domestic chain productions. Additionally, it strives to make Iran self-sufficient in the field of catalysts. Catalysts are broadly used to make metals. Powerhouse industries like Iran's steel and iron sectors rely heavily on catalysts for their outputs. Products from these industries are vital to downstream manufacturing sectors such as construction materials, cables, home appliances, and automobiles, just to name a few. All of these sectors are part of the process of adding value to materials that generate higher profits as well. Companies like the one we just mentioned play a big role in providing catalyst to the steel and iron industry. Based on figures from the World Steel Association, Iran is the world's 10th biggest steel producer. Last year, crude steel production stood at 27 million tons. That's in contrast to the year 2019, when the country produced over 30 million tons. But despite the apparent decline, Iran's world standing remains unchanged. Meanwhile, the government has implemented several plans to increase production in this key sector over the years. Industry participants expect Iran to climb to 7th place among global top steel producers by 2024. There are 30 active steel producers in the country with high production capacities. These companies receive most of the iron they need through domestic sponge iron producers. It might be interesting to know that Iran is the biggest producer of sponge iron in the West Asian region. That's going off of a recent report by the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries and Renovation Organization. The report also says Iran is globally ranked second in its productions, closely rivaling India at the top. Figures show that in 2020, domestic sponge iron production stood at 30 million tons, while India's was around 33 million.
As we mentioned earlier in the program, catalysts are necessary to make numerous items. That is why they are considered a strategic product. And in Iran, these pocket rockets play a significant role in the country's oil and petrochemical industry. Remarkably, without catalysts, Iran's thriving oil and gas industries would not thrive as they are today.
According to figures from the oil ministry, the country exported petrochemical and petroleum products worth around $20 billion in 2020. That is twice the value of Iran's crude exports. While most of the world's last refinery output during the coronavirus pandemic, Iranian gasoline exports rose in the year 2020. Going off of figures from the National Oil, Gas, and Petrochemical Products Exporters Union, exports hovered at 8 million tons that year. These gasoline exports generated an estimated $3 billion. Iran's oil and gas industry is still going strong, and there are many investment opportunities in this sector and its downstream industries.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there on the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
The foundation of knowledge-based companies is built on creating income from knowledge rather than natural resources. Firms involved in pharmaceuticals, health biotech, medical equipment, new materials, avionics, telecommunications, information technology, and software are considered to be in the knowledge-based industries. In this program, we are visiting a knowledge-based company that's involved in information technology. Most of the services that governments have to offer to people are in form of simple inquiries. In many of them, people have to make a payment. That includes bills, taxes, and whatnot. This company has managed to facilitate the process and design an online platform named Qabzino. The other group of services do not need payments. Those include checking your social security insurance records or your subsidy records. Such services are offered in another product named Pishkan 24, which is an online government services counter. The company is also planning to introduce a new product for car-related services to the market in the coming months. This company has managed to expand despite sanctions and other problems. Customer satisfaction has built their trust, and this has been a great incentive for the company to work harder to design new products. They also plan to enter the market and are looking for strategic partners abroad. Their goal is to attract domestic and foreign investment.
Without further ado, let's dive right into some news and trends regarding the mining and construction industry. As the young population in Iran matures, many of them are ready to purchase their first home. This has caused a housing shortage in the country. In response, the government has been pursuing a plan to build over 2 million affordable housing units nationwide.
Presently, the government has secured land for this construction project, which is in its first phase. Earlier this month, the government put out a public call for the registration of people in need of housing. So far, around 2.3 million people have signed up for the program. Meanwhile, large domestic companies are also bidding to participate in the massive national project. The government created the National Housing Movement in response to an estimated 10 million housing unit deficit nationwide.
The National Housing Movement will bolster construction and its related manufacturing sectors, but it has also gained the attention of Belgian companies who are keen to cooperate on this project.
According to the Iran-Belgium Chamber of Commerce, these companies are active in the field of modern construction materials. They have shown interest in setting up factories in Iran for manufacturing building parts and will be bringing advanced technologies and investment as well. An official with the Chamber of Commerce explains that building parts will be manufactured off-site. Then, they will be transferred to projects and assembled into larger sections on-site. The official said, negotiations between Iran and Belgium regarding construction date back to 2008, but was never really followed up until this year.
For our last bit of news, let's take a look at the mining sector. Iran has launched its first ever mining and mining industries innovation center in a bid to further expand the sector and develop the necessary technology.
Several knowledge-based firms will be operating out of this center, and five startups have also joined. The goal is to acquire new technologies in the field of mining and geology. Officials expressed hope that this infrastructure will encourage research and innovation in this field.
And there you have it. That covers our program for today. Thanks for joining us and see you next time for more exciting market and industry analysis on Bazaar.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
President Biden was livid. He had been in office only 2 months, and there was already a crisis at the southwest border of the United States. Thousands of migrant children were jammed into unsanitary border patrol stations. Republicans were accusing Mr. Biden of flinging open the borders, and his aides were blaming one another. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Zolan Kano Young, Michael Shear, and Eileen Sullivan. The piece is titled Disagreement and Delay: How Infighting Over the Border Divided the White House. President Biden was livid. He had only been in office for 2 months, and there was already a crisis at the southwest border of the United States. Thousands of migrant children were jammed into unsanitary border patrol stations. Republicans were accusing Mr. Biden of flinging open the borders, and his aides were blaming one another. Facing his bickering staff in the Oval Office that day in late March 2021, Joe Biden grew so angry at their attempts to duck responsibility that he erupted. "Who do I need to fire," he demanded, "to fix this?" Joe Biden came into office promising to dismantle what he described as the inhumane immigration policies of his predecessor, Donald J. Trump. But the episode, recounted by several people who attended or were briefed on the meeting, helps explain why that effort remains incomplete. For much of Joe Biden's presidency so far, the White House has been divided by furious debates over how and whether to proceed in the face of a surge of migrants crossing the southwest border of the United States. Senior Biden aides have been battling one another over how quickly to roll back the most restrictive policies and what kind of system would best replace them. Now Mr. Biden finds himself the target of attacks from all sides. Immigration activists accuse him of failing to prioritize the human rights of millions of immigrants. Conservatives have pointed to surges of migrants at the border as evidence that the president is weak and ineffective. And even some moderate Democrats now fear that lifting Trump-era border restrictions could hurt them politically. Officials from the Department of Homeland Security expect record numbers of migrants to cross the border this summer, just months ahead of the midterm elections that will determine control of Congress and help shape the arc of Joe Biden's presidency for the next 2 years. This account of the Biden administration's handling of the border over the past 15 months is based on interviews with 20 current and former officials, lawmakers and activists, most of whom requested anonymity to discuss private deliberations. President Biden came into office with high hopes, saying he wanted a system that would allow the United States to determine in a more compassionate way which migrants should be allowed to stay in the country. He recruited a team of immigration advocates and others eager to put in place the humane system they had envisioned for years. But the slow pace of change has left some of Joe Biden's longtime allies doubting his commitment and wondering whether he is more interested in keeping the highly charged issue from dominating his presidency. Virtually all of the aides who came on board early in the Biden administration have left the White House, frustrated by what they describe as repeated fights with some of the president's most senior advisers over whether to lift Trump-era policies. Even some of Joe Biden's more enforcement-minded aides have departed. White House officials did not dispute the internal disagreements over immigration. Vedant Patel, a spokesman for Mr. Biden, said the president understood that changing an outdated system was not going to happen overnight. Though he said, Joe Biden was working every day to secure our border and use the power we do have to build a fair, orderly and humane immigration system. But the border has been a constant headache for President Biden, one that ballooned into a series of crises even as he tried to stay focused on the coronavirus pandemic, the economy, Afghanistan, and the conflict in Ukraine. Our old debates about border security and deterrence and open borders are not capturing the actual policy challenge at hand, said Andrea Flores, who resigned as a director for border management at the National Security Council, disillusioned and frustrated by senior aides and the opportunities I saw them not take. Ron Klain issued a warning to his staff last summer. The White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, gathered senior aides, including Susan Rice, the president's domestic policy advisor, Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, the Homeland Security advisor, and Amy Pope, the top migration advisor, in the Roosevelt Room. Ron Klain told them that they needed to make sure the administration was not pandering to people who wanted an immediate end to Trump-era border restrictions, according to two people familiar with his comments. If they did not find a way to deter soaring illegal crossings at the southwest border of the United States, he said, accusations about border chaos would grow worse, anger moderate voters, and potentially sink the party during the 2022 midterm elections. The White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, was channeling his boss, who had complained to top aides about the intensifying attacks from Republicans, characterizing him as an open border president, according to a person familiar with Mr. Biden's comments. But the source of President's frustration was as much from inside his administration as it was from outside. As border crossings increased, disagreements erupted over how quickly to dismantle Donald Trump's anti-immigrant policies.